When all the preparations had been made, anxiously the mariners looked for the day. But alas, there was no abatement in the storm. It only revealed a rolling sea and a tempestuous sky. Now let us remember that in ancient vessels with one large mast and sail, instead of the strain being distributed over the whole body, it was concentrated on a small part of it, and therefore a greater tendency to a leakage would occur. In view of this, they proceeded to lighten it, and we, being exceedingly tossed, that is, hard pressed, began to throw the cargo overboard. This may be the deck cargo, or whatever might easily be spared. This was the second day. Then came the third day, and the storm still ran high, and the tackling of the ship was cast out. And this is thought to be the main yard, an immense spar nearly as long as the ship, which would require the united effort of crew and passengers. So the writer says, we cast it out. You will notice that in verse 18, it says they did it. But in verse 19, we did it. And this could account for the difference. The mental strain of mind and body, the demand for labor, the terror of the passengers, the laboring of the ship, the driving of the storm, the benumbing effect of cold and wet, now go to make up this scene of anxiety, of confusion, and of fatigue. Then followed subsequent days of despair, verse 20. A wild storm was raging, a grey sky overhead, during the day concealing the sun, and a black pall at night shutting out the stars. No observations could be made. Tossed at the mercy of wind and waves, with creaking timbers around them, hope began to die. The Roman soldier who has brave campaigns in distant lands believes his end has come. The weather-beaten sailor anticipates his ocean grave. Frantic shrieks and prayers of men calling on their gods complete the picture. Just how many days passed before Paul interposed and spoke for the second time, we do not know. But it was after long abstinence, verse 21. This abstinence was probably occasioned by certain provisions being spoiled by the rolling of the ship, which would cause quite a large amount of water to be in the hold. The protecting hand of heaven was still with the Apostle Paul, and as he had been divinely warned of the danger of the voyage, so now, while wrapped in sleep, and as the storm raged round him, he again received an intimation that he must stand before Caesar. At the moment when despair had laid its icy grip on every heart, the Apostle stands forth. And at this moment he commands the ship. His influence is felt. Like a captain he commands. Like a priest he offers prayers. Like a deliverer he is going to bring them safe to land. He reminds them of their folly in not listening to him. He turns their attention to God who commandeth and raiseth the stormy wind. And surely we have a sublime picture here as we see how the Christian is the truly courageous man in the world's history. He is brave in peril, he is trustful in danger, he is patient in the hour of affliction, he is calm when others are afraid, he is strong when others are weak. And now in verse 22, he exhorted them to be of good cheer. Well, surely, brothers and sisters, it seems worse than ironical to tell 276 sick men in this plight to cheer up. Such advice is not a known cure for this malady. Yet it is done twice in this chapter, for we read of it again in verse 25. But surely this showed the conviction of the truth of what Paul had said. Which conviction arose in him from faith in God. He believed what God had spoken would come to pass. Hence, he dismissed anxiety. If they believed him as he believed God, they might have done the same. He assured them, verse 22, that no lives would perish though the ship would be lost. Now, this was the result of a communication from God. Had he not already received a previous intimation that he must go to Rome and stand before Caesar? Which implied surely that his life would not be lost in that storm. But now a further statement was added. And this was that God had given him the lives of all his fellow passengers. And there's a great lesson here. We can see how a good man can be the means of being a channel of blessing to others. Remember, it was the same day that Lot went out of Sodom that it rained fire and brimstone from heaven. The same day, not before, the destruction of Sodom was delayed because of Lot. In the same way, when Joseph was in Potiphar's house in Egypt, God blessed the Egyptian's house and all that he had for Joseph's sake. In the same way, when the Ark of God remained 3 months in the house of Obed-Edom, the Lord blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that he had. And what the Ark was to that house, a faithful man became to those about him, a shield for their preservation in an hour of trial. And so the crew, the sailors, the passengers, were all to be preserved because Paul was in the ship. God is with him, and others are blessed through him, even though it be a lengthening of mortal life. Then in verse 23, he gives the reason for this declaration. There stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve. These words are very precious. Whose I am. He had been bought with a price. The very hairs of his head were numbered. All things worked together for him. Whom I serve. No higher title did the apostle want than this. A servant of God. It was his greatest honor to be so designated. His service was his pleasure. His will was absorbed in that of his master. He gloried in his sufferings as no monarch ever gloried in his crown. Then he told them in verse 26, howbeit, we must be brought upon a certain island. Now this was wonderful. Putting all these things together, this is what we have. Paul said the tempest would go on until the ship became a wreck. This wreck would be on some island, and yet there would not be the loss of a single life. What questions would puzzle the mind? What hopes and fears it could inspire in the heart? Yet Paul says, verse 25, I believe God that it shall be even as he hath told me. What a faith is here. A faith that rises above the raging of the sea. A faith that fills the heart with comfort and with hope. A faith that takes God at his word. A faith because of which difficulties did not matter. God would keep his promise. And so for 14 days they were driven through the waters of Adria. Where are the waters of Adria? Well, actually it is part of the Mediterranean Sea. It is that part of the Mediterranean Sea which lies between Italy and Malta and between Greece and Crete. and for 14 days they were driven through these waters. And then they deemed they drew nigh to some country. Now we are told that while it is a gale of 14 days, and such a gale is not often encountered, it is by no means unknown. For details of such gales, of such duration, have actually been recorded in the Mediterranean. The question we have to ask then is, how fast could a ship drift in this time? For that's what the ship was doing. Now, while it can vary slightly, reliable sources say, and the average has been confirmed, to be 36 miles in 24 hours. That is 1.5 miles per hour. So that in 13.5 days, this ship would drift 480 miles in the same direction, northwest, if the wind continued in the same direction. Now, the distance from Cora to Malta is between 480 and 500 miles in such a direction. Hence, the distance and the direction is correct. 480 miles in a northwesterly direction. But before we look at the land, let us look at the position of the ship on this 14th day. That is the 14th day from the bursting of the storm after leaving Fair Havens. The time is midnight, verse 27. Surely one of the worst hours of all to tempest-tossed sailors in a sinking ship. No moon, no stars. A season of deep horror and great danger. With the sound, too, of breakers in the distance, telling of an unknown land. It was an hour of acuteness of distress, and to the passengers must have been simply appalling. The sailors on the lookout, surmising from the sound of foam on the crested billows, which they heard dashing against the rocks, or the breaking of the waves on the beach, that they drew near to some country. But how did they know this? Well, the map of Malta will help us. The vessel approaching Malta first, in a northwesterly direction, has the coast many miles away, until a certain point is reached. This is known as Cura Point. Now this juts out and meets the ship within a quarter of a mile. It is a bold, precipitous headland, upon which the waves strike with violence. And undoubtedly some of the crew heard this and knew from experience it was the sound of water breaking on some rock-bound coast. And so immediately soundings were taken. The first sounding was 20 fathoms. A little later another sounding was taken, and it was measured as 15 fathoms, verse 28. They realized now there was no time to lose. Rocks may be near. Peril was imminent. And the mariners dropped into the sea 4 anchors in hope of retarding their fate. Now, ancient vessels did not carry large anchors. Therefore, they carried more of them. This number was not unusual. We know now that some ships carried 8 anchors. In fact, this ship had more than 4 anchors, because we are told in verse 30 that certain shipmen would have still cast the anchors out. Another thing about this is that it was not usual for them to be cast out of the stern. And the critic has come along and tried to find the difficulty here. No, it is understood that it was generally out of the bow that the anchors were cast. But had this ship been anchored from the bow, it might have struck around and fallen upon the rocks. And under these circumstances it is a known fact that a ship in cases of such peril was anchored from the stern. Now, while the tension of hope and fear and suspense, all these things coupled together through those hours of darkness on this 14th day, made them hope for the coming morn. Then, under pretense of lowering anchors from the foreship, a number of sailors rowed the boat into the sea. The boat that had been taken up, you remember. And mean-spirited and selfish would soon have been overboard, had not Paul, who now spoke for the third time, remonstrated with them. He said that unless they remained on board, the rest could not be saved. Verse 31. And with implicit faith in his words, the soldiers acted, held no discussion, and with a short sword which all Roman soldiers carried and fought their way through to every victory, they cut the ropes, and the boat drifted into the sea and out into the darkness. It has been said that at that moment, when the centurion ordered the boat's ropes to be cut, he went with his soldiers into the salvation boat of Paul's words, which was hung with fast cords to the faithfulness of God. At length the great horn of light began to relieve the intolerable gloom. It appeared to be raining, chapter 28 and verse 2. It was cold and wet, and they were surrounded with hunger and with fear. Now Paul speaks for the fourth time, verse 33. He repeated his assurance that not an hair of their head should perish. Verse 34. Not even the soldiers who had attempted to leave them. How they were going to all get ashore was yet beyond his knowledge. But he had implicit faith in God and believed that everyone should reach the beach alive. He besought them to take food. There was still some available, and they most certainly had not eaten adequate to their necessities. True, they were not going to perish from drowning, but they must see to it that they did not die from weakness by starvation. Hence he gave them an example. Verse 35. He took bread, gave thanks, and began to eat before them all. He thanked God in the presence of them all for the lives he had been instrumental in saving, and for the prospect of safety that lay before them. What a picture is this! A shackled prisoner in the grey dawn, amid the rain and storm, amid the howling of the winds, the dashing of the waves, and maybe the shrieking of the passengers, the cursing of the soldiers, and the shouting of the prisoners. A shackled prisoner giving thanks to God and eating. What a picture! Oh, to have seen Paul's face at that moment and to have heard his words. How it impressed them we shall never know, but how it affected them is given to us in verse 36. Then were they all of good cheer. And that is how twice the Apostle Paul had asked them to be. And they also took some meat. And now 276 souls with haggard faces cluster on the deck and peer out in the dim morning beyond the terrors of the storm. Verse 37. After having partaken of the food, they began for the third time to lighten the ship, in order for it to run as far inshore as possible. And we are told in verse 38 that they cast out the remaining wheat. But now, verse 39, it was day. The land was visible. They did not know it, for this was not the usual spot at which ships landed at Malta. But they saw a creek with a sandy beach, and there proposed running the ship aground. Now the first thing they did was to take up the anchors. Then they loosed the lashing with which they had been secured to the ship. Then they hoisted up the foresail to the wind and made for the shore. Now we do want to remember, brothers and sisters, that since midnight, through the long hours of the dark, most of these people had been awake. And they had been awake in fear and dread. And now, in the grey dawn, was to come the ordeal of landing. Just how? They did not know. But at length, with all the preparations made, the impatient ship tears away by bursting through the breakers, through the foam, and through the spray which rises around, and in a minute or so strikes the beach. Verse 41. Her bow is fast in the sand, and her stern is being pounded and is now breaking up by the waves. And Luke says they had run into a place where two seas met. Verse 41. And this was absolutely true, because look at the map now of Malta. Here, just away from Malta, is Salmonetta Island. It is separated from the mainland by a channel about 100 yards wide. Here we are told two currents still meet and still mingle their waters. And examination has proved that the bottom here consists of mud and clay. In this mud and clay the bow stuck. How rich are the ways of providence! Otherwise the boat would have been dashed to pieces on the rocks. We cannot imagine the consternation at this moment. Ah, but even now while we are speaking, the vessel is breaking up under the lash of the waves. Now we have already said that a Roman soldier was answerable with his own life for the life of his prisoner. And their counsel at this moment was to kill the prisoners, lest any of them should swim and escape. At this moment, notwithstanding their terrible responsibility, it was surely an inhuman act, and it might have been carried out if Julian, the centurion, had not intervened. But here is also a picture of base ingratitude, for remember, Paul was one of the prisoners, and to kill the prisoners involved his death with the rest. A man to whom they had already more than once owed their lives. So again, Julian, the centurion, stood in the breach. Oh, there is no doubt about it at all that Paul had made a deep impression upon this man, an impression that could not be erased. And he was willing to save the apostle. So he made a suggestion. It was that those among the soldiers who could swim should cast themselves overboard and get first to land, in which case they could both look after the prisoners as they arrived and also extend an helping hand to any of the passengers who needed it. What a wonderful and wise provision this was. Hence, once again, at the very last hurdle, the apostle's life was saved by the vigilance of the centurion. And in this we cannot fail to see the hand of God. The ship has fallen to pieces, and everybody is saving themselves the best that they can, until on broken pieces of wood and planks severed away from the ship, they all got safe to land. Thus these 276 people who had been exposed to a common peril, yet inspired to a common hope, who had been engaged in a common work, were now recipients of a common mercy. Such is the wonderful story of the 27th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles. We have visited many lands: Syria, Cyprus, Asia Minor, the Greek archipelago, Crete, Corda, Malta. We have really crossed several seas: the Mediterranean, the Sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, the Aegean, and the waters of Adria. Look at the cities we have visited: Caesarea, Sidon, Myra, Snidus, Fair Havens, together with Cape Matala, Phoenix, and Cura Point. And now, for a few moments in conclusion, let us take this journey as an allegory of our life. My dear brethren and sisters, all of us are on the ship of mortal life. Every one of us is sailing across the sea of time. Like on Paul's ship, what a strange admixture of travels there are. Like the captain, there are those who have the right to command us. Like the soldiers, there are those in whose power we stand. Like the sailors, there are those whose duty it is to care for our safety. Like Paul, there are those who can enlighten us. Like Luke, there are those who can heal us. Like Aristarchus, there are those who can refresh us. And like the prisoners, there are those who are our fellow sufferers. Just as it was on Paul's ship, where there were Romans, Macedonians, Alexandrians, and Hebrews, we find ourselves in a world of nations. On life's journey, there cannot be absolute seclusion or refined retirement, no more than there was on the ship. For it is only by this that experience is gained, or that discipline can make itself known. But as we journey on, not only varied is our company, but difficulties, hardships, and perils are certain. The wind at times is sure to be contrary, and the sea tempestuous. Sunshine will give place to storm, just as Fair Havens gave place to Cape Matala. And the changing drama of the sea well pictures the changing scenes of human life. What is it that avails at such times? It is faith in God. And it is very true to say that God helps those who help themselves. For while God was in the storm, it was man who had to handle the tackling of the ship, showing us that with faith should go prudence, and with entreaty, effort. We do also well to notice that for 14 days, these seamen, soldiers, and mixed multitude lived on the brink of a watery grave. They had fasted and prayed, for 14 days instructed by the greatest apostle of Christ and two other admirable men. And yet at the end, knowing nothing but self-love, were about to steal the boat and leave everyone to the mercy of the waves, while the soldiers agreed to kill the prisoners, lest they should be punished for letting them escape. So, brethren and sisters, on this voyage of life, if with Paul you can say of God, whose I am and whom I serve, and those with whom you come in contact will spurn the message of divine mercy and the overtures of divine grace, then the apostle is your companion in this story of the sea. And yet, notwithstanding this, the world is greatly blessed by Christians being in it. They are its salt. They are its light. They are a breath of fresh air permeating the humid atmosphere which surrounds them. And it is only that faith can triumph. It is only that faith that can triumph in the face of this dark despair. My dear brethren and sisters, our course in the world is not a picnic, but a time of probation. But at last, with all dangers past, with all difficulties endured, with all obstacles overcome, as Paul reached Rome, the faithful servant will reach the city of God. And so, we have seen how advancing science ever brings new material to strengthen God's word. But isn't that just how it is with all sciences? When little understood, they seem to contradict it. When better understood, they have the appearance of harmony. And when fully understood, that harmony is complete. So the Bible has been threatened by all sciences, yet outlives them, and beholds them bring their tribute to its feet. Thus the coastlines of these ancient seas, under the light of modern geography, illumine the pages of Luke. His details stand the test of time, and evidence accumulates for the correctness of the historical events which he narrates. The mountains, the hills, the bays, the indentations of the coast, the winds that blow, the storms that beat around Matara's head, the waves that break in foam on Cura's point, now declare to us, as with united voice, thy word is truth.